Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth interviews David Duchovny, who then takes a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
The one-year anniversary of President Trump's inauguration was marked this weekend by nationwide protests and a government shutdown that ended today despite Trump doing as little as possible to resolve it. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. It's been a year since Trump's inauguration and the historic women's marches that followed. And on Saturday, we saw yet again that the women's march wasn't merely a one-time phenomenon, but a sustained movement unlike anything the country's seen in decades.
Women across the country were on the march today. Thousands took to the streets from coast to coast. They rallied for a variety of causes with a focus on having their voices heard in November's midterm elections.
Taking to the streets in over 300 rallies in all 50 states.
But it just wasn't in the U.S. where women and women marched. This was the scene in Nova Scotia where half the town of Sandy Cove also participated in the women's march.
Wow. Half the town was protesting. That, I have to say, that's got to be super awkward for people who weren't there. Dale, I didn't see you at the women's march. Oh, yeah, was it a good turnout? Half, Dale. It was half. Of course, one of the best parts of any protest are the signs, and this year it was especially refreshing to see children participating, like this sign that said, "Vote for Women." This sign that said, "Boys are equal to girls and girls are equal to boys." And then there was this little girl who clearly got to write her own sign. Although, to be fair, it's possible she spent more time on that than the Trump administration did on the original travel ban.
Don't forget the purple circles. The purple circles make it legally airtight.
Of course, Trump, who was cooped up in the White House all weekend watching coverage of the protests, couldn't help but weigh in, tweeting, "Beautiful weather all over our great country, a perfect day for all women to march. Get out there now to celebrate the historic milestones and unprecedented economic success and wealth creation that has taken place over the last 12 months, lowest female unemployment in 18 years. Dude, you know that's not why they were marching. Trump's the kind of guy who, if he came home to find his wife dumped all his clothes on the sidewalk, would say to her, "I get it. You want to see me naked." I pick up on stuff. So the one-year anniversary of Trump's inauguration saw a second straight year of sustained nationwide protests. But, of course, it wasn't just the protests that marred Trump's celebration.
The government is shut down for the first time in more than 4 years. The art of the deal, president could not reach that deal with Democrats and a few Republicans. And just a few hours ago, they marked the one-year anniversary of his presidency by rejecting a budget bill.
This is the first time in modern history, the first time in modern U.S. history, that a party that's controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House has had a government shutdown on their watch.
You gotta hand it to Trump. He finally did something no other president has ever done.
Bush couldn't do it. Obama couldn't. We made history. We made history.
Now, Trump has, of course, tried to claim it's actually Democrats who will suffer politically from the shutdown, tweeting over the weekend, "This is the one-year anniversary of my presidency, and the Democrats wanted to give me a nice president. Hashtag Democrat shutdown." But there's at least one immutable law of physics that still applies in Washington. For each Trump quote, there's an equal and opposite Trump quote. And the question of who's to blame for government shutdowns is no exception, because when Obama was president, Trump was very clear about who was to blame.
Who's going to bear the brunt of the responsibility if indeed there is a shutdown of our government?
Well, if you say who gets fired, it always has to be the top. I mean, problems start from the top, and they have to get solved from the top, and the president's the leader. In 25 years and 50 years and 100 years from now, when the government is, you know, they talk about the government shutdown, they're going to be talking about the president of the United States. Who was the president at that time?
If there is a shutdown, I think it would be a tremendously negative mark on the president of the United States. I hear the Democrats are going to be blamed and the Republicans are going to be blamed. I actually think the president would be blamed.
There's literally, literally. Not one situation where there isn't an old Trump quote that completely contradicts his current position. I wouldn't be surprised if there's an old Trump tweet out there that says, only a loser would wear a baseball cap with a suit. In fact, Trump was asked point blank in 2011 how he would handle a potential shutdown differently from then President Obama. And in retrospect, let's say he was a little overconfident.
I'm a deal man. I made hundreds and hundreds of deals and transactions. He never did deals before. How can you expect a man that's not a deal man, that never did a deal, other than, frankly, becoming president of the United States, he never did a deal, how's he going to corral all these people?
So how would you do it now? Now, you're in the Oval Office right now.
I would get everybody together, and we'd have a budget, and it would
get done. They've all gotten together.
Well, that's because they don't have the right leader. You don't have the right leader. This is the president of the United States has to get this done. But it's pretty sad because the whole world is looking at us and laughing at us.
It's amazing. I agree with everything he just said. Of course, in reality, Republicans control all three branches of government. And on top of that, we have a president who repeatedly sold himself on the campaign trail as an ultimate deal maker.
We need a president that's going to be able to make deals, great deals.
I want to make great deals. That's what it is, for the people. I do hundreds of deals. The deals come out of my ears.
If you can't make a good deal with a politician, then there's something wrong with you. You're certainly not very good.
You can't leave the White House, go to Hawaii and play golf for 3 weeks and be a real deal maker. It doesn't work that way.
That's right. You can't go to Hawaii to play golf and be a deal maker. You have to go to Florida. And you can't do it for 3 weeks. You have to do it for an entire year. And yet, even as the government shutdown ended, the self-proclaimed deal man was MIA, completely absent from the negotiations and leaving everyone confused about where he stood. In fact, in order to counter that growing impression that Trump was sitting around doing nothing, the White House released a series of official photos of what they called President Donald J. Trump working in the White House during the Democrat shutdown, including this photo of Trump walking around, this photo of Trump talking to people, and this photo of Trump supposedly on the phone. Look at him.
Hello, police. Come quick. Somebody stole all the work off my desk.
You know, you don't really look like you're working when you're staring directly at the camera. You look like you just got busted having phone sex.
I gotta call you back.
The main reason the government was in this mess in the first place is that Trump doesn't know what he believes, other than the fact that he spent the entire campaign promising to build a wall, and now his party is scrambling to find a way to follow through on that promise, even though they know it's absurd. Even Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, reportedly told lawmakers Trump's promises on the wall were uninformed, and is now saying the so-called wall doesn't even have to be an actual physical barrier.
Did he really say the president was uninformed on the wall?
Yes. Well, I had a meeting. I was sitting right next to him, next to Mr. Kelly, and here's what he said. He said, the president of the United States, when he was campaigning, made promises that were not fully informed. He said, I've educated the president, and the president has evolved on the issue. And when I asked General Kelly, what's a wall? He said, it could be the inhospitable terrain. It could be Border Patrol agents. It could be drones.
Oh, my God, this wall keeps getting worse and worse. It could be terrain. It could be drones. Soon it's just going to be a tunnel painted on the side of a mountain. So we have a president making cartoonish demands that everyone knows are impractical, who has absolutely no guiding principles or knowledge of policy, and who changes his views on a whim depending on who he's talking to. And a former campaign aide told the New York Times that Trump doesn't even care to learn. The misconception is that the president does not know what he does not know. In my experience, the reality is that the president knows what he does not know and does not think he needs to know it. So it's simple. It's not that he does not know what he does not know. It's that he does know what he does not know, which means he doesn't know what he does know, and he does think that he doesn't need to know it. You know? Just to give you an idea of how incoherent and scattershot Trump's views are, he spent the weekend bashing Democrats over DACA, tweeting that Dems just want illegal immigrants to pour into our nation unchecked, even though he himself has spent months insisting that he wants to deal with the Dreamers, the young, undocumented immigrants brought here as children, with compassion.
The DACA situation is a very, very, it's a very difficult thing for me because, you know, I love these kids. I love kids. I have kids.
They shouldn't be very worried. They are here illegally. They shouldn't be very worried. I do have a big heart. We're going to take care of everybody.
Well, I have a great heart for the folks we're talking about, a great love for them. I feel having the Democrats in with us is absolutely vital because this should be a bipartisan bill. This should be a bill of love. Truly, it should be a bill of love.
Of course, a bill of love is also what Trump pays porn stars in hush money. This weekend's shutdown was very much the Trump presidency in microcosm, a president with no guiding principles and no knowledge of policy, flailing wildly and relegated to making cartoonish demands from the sidelines while everyone else scrambles to figure out how to make it work. I don't know what Trump would say about that, but I do know how his biggest critic feels.
The whole world is looking at us and laughing at us.
He's right. This has been A Closer Look. Our guest tonight is a Golden Globe-winning actor you know from his work as FBI agent Fox Mulder in The X-Files. New episodes air Wednesday nights on Fox. Please welcome back to the show, David Duchovny, everyone. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So this is now...
I love it in scenes where they write the name of the person you're supposed to be discussing on a big piece of paper as Hangman.
Yeah, so that's...
David can't remember his lines. Let's do a whole episode of Hangman.
Oh, so you're the kind of actor that just loves it. If it's right there on the paper, you don't have to rehearse.
Well, many times I want to be the actor who cheats that way, like on a computer, and I'll write what I'm supposed to be seeing on the computer or commenting on the computer on the computer, and then I'll start to feel so guilty that I'm a crappy actor and I should have memorized my line. And then my eyes have gotten worse, so I can't even read what I've written. My handwriting is so bad and so small, and I'm there, and I don't know my lines now, and everybody knows that I'm a crappy actor, and I've been trying to cheat, and it's just awful.
Well, I don't think you're a crappy actor.
Well, thanks.
I do think you should have figured all this out by now, because this is now 25 years.
Yeah.
25 years of Mulder. Did you ever think, I mean, no one thinks this, but what's it been like to play a character for this long, and has it been nice to have the breaks that you've had, obviously? Because it's not been 25 years straight.
It's like Mulder again. Yeah. I don't know that I can compare it to anybody else's job because, you know, I started playing this guy in 93, and he has a certain kind of, like, anti-establishment energy, and I would have had that too. You know, I auditioned for it irreverently in a tie with pigs on it.
You wore a pig tie when you auditioned?
I thought that was, like, irreverent.
Yeah. Did they like that? Did they say, you're our guy, when they saw it?
No, they said, we thought you were our guy until we saw the pig tie. And then, you know, now I'm playing him 25 years later, and he's still kind of anti-establishment, but you can't play it with the same kind of energy that you do as a young man. It has to have ripened into some other kind of decrepitude.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like an energetic decrepitude, if you know what I'm saying. So that's really what I've been trying to find, is an energetic decrepitude.
Oh, well, there. That seems like something worth
and
fighting for.
I feel
for.
Like in this moment right here, I found it.
You found it. An interesting thing that's happened is it feels like the world has caught up to the Mulder worldview in 1993 of don't trust the government. That now seems to be like a platform you can even run on.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting because when we first started doing the reboot, I was like, oh my God, is Mulder kind of in league with President Cole? You know, like,
yeah.
And by the way, I think the word you're looking for is blank.
Yeah. Oh, think we should just go blank?
Blank.
Yeah.
Is perfectly acceptable.
Right. Now that's like a game.
Blank.
Yeah.
Blank countries.
Yeah.
Since hole or house is the one that's open to conjecture.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think, Mulder was saying that the government is lying about aliens and stuff like that. And what is coming out of the President Cole's White House is that they're delegitimizing every news source.
Yeah, so it's not just aliens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, aliens is the only thing they're giving us.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so.
Do you... you obviously spent a lot of time with this character. Do you think Mulder is a good FBI agent?
He's the worst.
Yeah.
We've done about 213 or 218 episodes.
Yeah.
And he has solved nary a case.
Yeah, it's really the opposite of Law and Order. It never ends in a courtroom.
Yeah, it's like no laws and no order.
Yeah. No arrests. 25 years and no arrests.
Damn it. Again. You know, and it's like, by the fourth season of the show, like, we'd become a big hit, and it started to reflect in the writing a little bit where Gillian Anderson's character and I would walk into a scene, and people would go, oh, my God, it's Mulder and Scully. And I'm like, no. It's like, oh, it's Mulder and Scully.
Right.
But it was like the real-world appreciation of our characters that kind of infected
the fake
world.
Yeah, yeah. Like, well, that's now it's a really... This should be Trump's favorite show. One, you don't trust the government, and two, you're an FBI agent, doesn't know what he's doing. This is like Trump. Trump's like, this is what I've been saying about everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we didn't shoot a scene like our boss is named Skinner, and he always has the president's picture. So we've had Clinton, and we've had Bush, uh-huh. and we've had Obama even. So we've had three, and I was so terrified that we're gonna have to shoot a scene with
you shot around it
with Orange Julius. And I don't know. I guess we weren't in Skinner's office, so
yeah.
We kind of got away with it.
Oh, good. Well, it should have just been a cup of Orange Julius. Chris
you
Carter.
Know, like, as a kid, I tried to recreate Orange Julius for years. Do you know what Orange Julius is?
Yeah. I'd say it's less people every day.
They've got a secret recipe, and my buddy Eric Hager and I, after school, we'd come home and try. Is it egg? Is it cream cheese? Anyway, that's
you never figured it out.
We can talk about that
you
later.
You tried to bust the secret formula.
Coconut.
For
you know, we had big brainstorms, but we never got it.
You never got it.
Wow. Ice? Is it ice?
I'm sorry to hear that. I feel like now you could probably just walk in there and like buy the secret recipe for $100.
I know.
Yeah.
But it's fake.
It's fake. how far in advance do you know the arcs of your stories, not just the episodes, but the season? Does Chris Carter talk to you guys about it ahead of time?
I don't know it right now.
Okay, gotcha.
We finished shooting.
So it's not that you haven't had it. You've had it and it's just gone.
I don't pay attention. You know, if it's not written on my computer,
yeah.
It's the first time I've seen it. It's right here. No, actually, to be completely honest with you, we didn't know. Jillian and I didn't know the final scene of the 10th episode, which is the last episode of this year, until we were shooting it. Like, the pages were delivered hot off the presses.
Oh, wow.
And we're like, oh, I was like, oh, my God, I'm gay. I didn't know that. 25 years.
25 years. If they gave you a script from 1994, how far into shooting do you think you would say, oh, wait, I think we did this before?
it's funny because like everything I've done kind of molds into one hairball of a career, and I sometimes I remember things from other shows and other movies that I've done, and I can't be right or I don't even know. But sometimes something will ring a bell and I'll go, I think we've done that, but I you know, we probably have.
You have a lot of many other skills. Is it your second album that you're releasing?
Yeah, second album.
And you have a song that's in. Congratulations, that's fantastic.
Thank you.
And one of your songs is actually in an episode.
Chris Carter was nice enough to use one of my songs, but not my performance of the song.
Oh, really? So he said we like that, but we got to get somebody else to sing
somebody
it.
Somebody better. Yeah. No, but I get it. I mean, I think hearing my voice on the
track, that would be weird.
Be a little weird. But yeah, and it's a punk version.
That's good.
My music is not punky at all, but it's in this next episode that's airing on Wednesday. So
you're going on tour. You're going to Australia and New Zealand to play music.
Yeah, to play music.
How did you choose to go there?
Just pick the furthest country that would be the most hellish flight.
Yeah.
And, you know, try to imagine a tour in which I would suffer from jet lag the entire time.
How many shows do you do when you go over there?
About 2 weeks.
Oh, that's great.
Probably like 8, 9, 10 shows.
That's really exciting.
It really is.
And on top of that, you also just wrote your third novel.
Yeah.
Which is also amazing. I know we talked about your second novel last time you were here. When you start writing, do you know it's a novel when you start, or do you think this might be a short story?
No, like, sometimes I think it's a post-it.
Okay, gotcha. You know,
just like maybe a note to self.
Right.
And then I'm like, on the fridge, like, that's a good one right there.
Yeah. There's more to just pick up eggs.
Yeah, there is. That's a movie. You don't really know. I mean, one of the fun things about having different media to involve myself in is, like, ideas will, like, announce themselves as certain things. It's a post-it or a poem or a novel.
And do you know when you're done? When you finish your books, have you had that moment of, that's it, nailed it? Or do you kind of say, like, I need to turn this in?
You don't know me. I never did.
You're not nailed it guy?
It's like, that's it. I got nothing else. With books, you know, because one of the things that attracted me about doing books was that I love collaborating, but it's not collaborative in that you have the whole thing. It's just you. I'm not saying anybody else's words. I'm not with a band. I'm just me.
Yeah.
So it is. There is that moment where you're like, yeah, I think this is done.
Well, that's great. Well, congratulations on that and everything else. It's always such a pleasure to see you. David Duchovny, everybody, the X-Files. There's Wednesday nights on Fox.
Hey, everybody. This is Kevin, one of the producers here at Late Night. We are backstage with David Duchovny. David, thanks for taking a couple additional questions here.
Thank you.
We talked a little bit with Seth about it, but you have your second album coming out next month.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this one's called Every Third Thought. The first time I recorded, I was really not much of a musician. I'm still not, but I mean, I was really just starting out, especially with my voice. And I remember we were recording the first song, which ended up not being on the album, not because it was crap, but it just ended up not making the cut.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably after about 6 or 7 hours of trying to get through the verses and the chorus of the song, I just found myself lying on my back in the soundstage, like saying, this was a huge mistake. Like, let's just cut our losses and stop right now. And
yeah. Well, you haven't been playing guitar all that long, right?
No, I wasn't trying to record guitar. It was really just singing that was killing me at that point. And, you know, eventually relaxed, and it's different to try to sing into a microphone alone in a booth. It's different from performing live and all that stuff. And it's just a matter of getting used to it like anything. Like, I remember back when I started acting, you know, I'd have a lot more nerves than I do now.
Do you still get nervous before you either perform or...
I don't get nervous performing music for some reason. I don't know why. I think it's just so loud. I figure they can't really hear me. I don't know what it is, but I don't. I'll get nervous acting more than singing, which makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah. You guys are going to tour in Australia and New Zealand at your concerts and your shows. What's a fan interaction like?
It all depends. You know, we were playing once in Amsterdam, and this dude jumped up on stage and picked me up like a baby in his arms.
Great.
And it was odd. But I didn't know. I thought maybe this is a thing you do in the Netherlands. Yeah. I didn't know. So I picked him up afterwards. And I found out later we were married. After that. That's how you do it. It's usually, you know, I try to interact with you know, that's kind of the great thing about playing live music is you know, every night is different.
Yeah.
And it's very much like live theater. You know, every songs go over differently, different nights, and audiences connect to different songs on different nights. And it's really that's what I really enjoy about it, is that you don't know what's gonna happen.
Have you had a strange or memorable fan interaction with fans of X-Files?
X-Files?
Yeah.
No, but I used to, the first year of the show, I used to open my fan mail. I would get fan mail, and I didn't have a service, probably because I was cheap, but there wasn't that much fan mail. So they would give me Friday, you know, from the office would come this envelope, and there'd be 40 letters, you know, nothing. Not too much, and And I would diligently go through the stuff, and I would try to sign, you know, if they sent me the self-addressed stamped envelope, the SASC, and I would sign whatever they put in there, and I'd drop it in the mail. And a lot of the times they would write kind of sad stories, because I realized at that point that the people really felt when the show first was airing that, first of all, that these were real stories, that these were X-Files that existed in the FBI. So people thought, oh, my God, this is really happening, and the government isn't telling us. And secondly, there was a significant amount of people who felt like they hadn't had a show to speak to them. You know, they hadn't had a show that spoke to them, A, like the government is lying to us, and B, that there's shit out there that we don't know. You know, crazy ESP alien shit. And so you had people writing to me as if I was a real person doing these things. And that gives you a sense in which their level of reality already. And then they, you know, I remember reading these letters about people who said they'd been abducted and they'd been f***ed with, you know, and they, you know, they were sad. It was sad to read these things, and I could not help, you know, and they wanted me to help. It was like, I don't know if you ever read Miss Lonely Hearts by Nathaniel West, you know, it was a little like that, because there was significant, though small, part of the population that really glommed onto the show right away as if it was, oh my God, finally there's something for me. You know, it's not funny to think back on that, but it was significant.
Yeah. Is this the last season, or is that still
I don't know.
Up in the air?
I mean,
yeah.
You know, it depends on so many different things. Yeah. I just don't say, I just never say that, because I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the show is infinitely kind of flexible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even if it was to go on without me or without Jillian, that's a possibility too. Because I think why not? Why not keep making? There isn't really any show that's been like it, and still there isn't. So why not?
Well, I hope it continues for a long time.
Thank you.
Thanks again for taking some more questions.
Sure.
Right here. All right,
yeah,
great.
My pleasure.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.